The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
After Trump's comments, the Kremlin said Trump was showing signs of emotional overload after he called Vladimir Putin absolutely crazy following Moscow's largest aerial assault on Ukraine. Trump's outburst came after at least six people died in what Kyiv claims is the largest drone attack since Moscow launched the full-scale invasion in February of 2022. John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics and Jean Monnet, Chair of European Integration at Maynooth University, is with me now. John, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, first of all, what do you make of that spat between Trump and Putin? I mean, do you make anything of it at all?
Well, I think it reflects one important part of the war that is really to the fore now, which is the psychological war between Putin and Zelensky. So we've got the physical war, which is going on in the Donbass. We've got a war against civilians that the Russians have really escalated in recent days. You referred to the 300 plus drones per night that have been hitting Ukraine, more than 1,000 since Friday. But I think more than anything, both sides are trying to demonstrate to the public and to Trump in different ways, through different kinds of signalling, that they want peace. Now, it's very clear to me that if we look back at what happened last week, Trump and Putin spoke on the phone last Monday. Putin failed to turn up to the talks in Istanbul. I think Zelensky's turning up there was part of the psychological war, and I think he kind of gained some kudos.
But with that call between Trump and the two-hour call or whatever it was, Putin made little of it. In fact, he took it out of school. He was actually, he didn't even bother do the formal thing in the Kremlin, you know, a photo op. No, he was in a school.
It was
kind of diminishing.
Yeah, and of course, he also sent to Istanbul a very low-level delegation, where Zelensky was accompanied by all of his top people. So Putin is not serious about peace. That's very clear to me. What he wants is Ukraine, all of it, subordinated completely to Russia. And you can see that in the extraordinary demands they're making for a ceasefire. But for Trump, I think the more interesting question is the difference between his rhetoric as it's expressed in truths and tweets and so on, and what he actually does. And the simple truth is that since he came to office on the 20th of January, he has done nothing that could damage Russian interests. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. He's tried in every way possible to normalize relations with
Russia. Even his comments about Putin, I know the guy, I like him, he's very nice, you know, we get on really well, this kind of talk.
He obviously didn't learn from George W. Bush, who said, remember 20 years ago, that he looked into Putin's soul and he saw a good man. I mean, it's extraordinary how people in the West have been taken in by Putin and still don't seem to understand him now, after 20 plus years.
This intensification of the Russian attacks on the civilian areas and infrastructure and so on, how long can they sustain that? Because this could be, if you like, their last great flourish.
Yeah.
They've, according to the Ukrainians, the Russians have lost 1 million troops, be they wounded or killed, in this conflict. And you're talking about Shahed drones and all of that. There cannot be an inexhaustible supply of that kind of equipment.
Well, there are interesting statistics that you can look at. They have lost, according to those calculations, 30 to 40 times the number of troops they lost in Afghanistan over 10 years, a third of the period of the current war. It was three times longer. And many analysts suggest it was part of the reason that the Soviet Union collapsed. But if you look at production of armaments, the Russians are producing their own Shahed drones. So last year they were buying them almost exclusively from Iran. Now they have the capacity to produce them. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing this escalation. But they've simply got many more of them.
If you were to cast your mind back to World War II, and you would see that munitions production in Britain escalated dramatically, and in Germany, of course, but at huge cost to the availability of normal commodities to the general public.
Yeah.
So it must be hurting Russia in some way to divert so much of their energy and money to the war effort.
It is, but still they're spending only about 7% of overall gross national product on defense and security. If we go back to that period in the Cold War, they were spending double that. And again, there are many people who believe that the Americans won the Cold War because they outspent the Soviets, that Moscow simply didn't have the capacity to keep increasing spending because the cost of that was visible in the shops where nothing was for sale and there were queues for virtually everything from bread and milk and other staples. That's not happened so far, Pat, for a whole variety of reasons. And I think it's unlikely to happen in the immediate future. But Russia is under enormous pressure. Amongst other reasons, the oil price, which they need to sustain the war, is significantly lower now than they require. It's about $62, $63 a barrel, I think, in recent days. They probably need a level of $90 to $100 a barrel to be able to sustain the war and not make drastic cuts in public spending.
What about the depletion of their manhood? I mean, literally, the number of men going to war and not coming back are coming back maimed and, incapable of being productive members of society after this war. And, you know, the women of Russia, the mothers, the sisters, the wives, how long will they tolerate this rate of attrition?
Well, firstly, it has been an extraordinary rate of attrition. I think the figures that suggest at least 200,000 dead Russian soldiers are probably accurate. But they seem to have an inexhaustible supply of manpower. Now, they're getting them from the minority groups in Central Asia. They've emptied the prisons. They've done all of those kinds of things. The one thing they haven't done yet is to impose conscription in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And to me, that would be the game changer if they were forced to do that at some point in the future. But to an extent, that's dependent on the amount of aid that Ukraine gets to sustain the war and what the United States does, whether Trump is prepared to honour the minerals deal, for example, and resume the supply of arms and financial aid to Ukraine.
I mean, the solution to the two major wars that we have in our headlines all the time, there are other wars ongoing. But if Trump was to deny Israel armaments from the United States and arm Ukraine, both conflicts could stop tomorrow.
Absolutely. And the other part of this, I think, with Israel is trade. Now, we have seen over the last week or so in the European Union a real change in the rhetoric and in the mood. But for me, from the very beginning, the EU had this great weapon that it could use against Israel, which was trade. And it absolutely refused to do it, despite the fact that Article 2 of the Association Agreement, which is about 20 years old now, explicitly contains human rights provisions that Israel is in serial violation of. What was lacking then, and I think is still lacking, is the political will to actually follow through with that kind of policy.
But the political will seems to be hardening. I mean, in terms of France, now Germany, and Chancellor Merz suggesting, or saying explicitly, that Ukraine will have access to long-range weapons. On Gaza, saying that it is no longer justifiable what's going on by Israel in Gaza, no longer justifiable. In other words, they were prepared to support to a point, but now Israel has gone OTT.
I think that's very true, but I think the other significant thing here is the presence, the new presence in Europe of Friedrich Merz. He signaled during the election campaign that he was going to take a much tougher stance with Russia than Olaf Scholz did. And I think what we're seeing now in his giving consent to Ukraine using long-range weapons, that's part of this. Another part of it will have to be Germany itself rearming, and he's completely committed to that. We have a new era opening up in Germany where they're going to literally spend up to $1 trillion on defense. Part of that, I've no doubt, will be for Ukraine, whatever form that takes in the months to come. But Germany will become vital, I think, especially if the United States withdraws from that support for Ukraine that's been there from the beginning.
So now we have a situation where on Ukraine and attitude to Russia, that Merz has hardened Germany's position. But going to the Israeli situation, because of the Holocaust and so on, German politicians have been reluctant ever to criticize Israel overtly. And you can understand why. That's a national embarrassment what happened in those years. But now, he said, enough is enough.
That's what he's saying. But what is he going to do, and what is Germany prepared to do? And I think the review of the association agreement in the EU is a really important test case. And if we don't see the huge majority of member states weighing in behind that, I think nothing is going to change. What I have wanted actually for some time, Pat, and argued for was that Ireland alone should have instigated a full trade embargo against Israel. Now, the government was failing even to pass the Occupied Territories Bill. Now, I know there have been developments there, but what would have happened in that situation? Well, the government says we can't do it because trade is a European competence. I always believed that was wrong, that we should have dared the European Commission, if we really believed in the Palestinian cause, to take us to court. And that's a very normal occurrence within the European Union. We face these infringement proceedings very regularly on the environment because of our failure to transpose one piece of legislation or another. So we could have done that. And the value of it, I think, would have been that Article 2 would have been tested in court finally. What is the meaning of the human rights provisions in the trade agreement? We are moving slowly and inexorably to see that tested. I would like to see it expedited and see it before the Court of Justice quickly.
John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics and Jean Monnet, Chair of European Integration at Maynooth University. John, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.